Okay, so we're doing the last Mishnah here, Perkei Mish Yud Alef of Hezu Neshech, and this is not a hard Mishnah. The Mishnah says, Ve'elu, and these characters, Ovrin below Sasa. The following people are all transgressing one or more different prohibitions of the Torah when they participate in a loan that involves ribus. Hamalva, the lender. Vahalova, the borrower. He's also in violation. Vahayarev, the arev is the guarantor who participates and facilitates a loan to be made because he guarantees the lender that he'll be repaid in case the borrower doesn't come through with the money. Vahedim, and the witnesses who facilitate the loan happening by witnessing it, they also are participating in an interest, prohibited interest-bearing loan, they're also over Doraisa. V'cham omrim, the rabbis added on top, those are Doraisas. The rabbis added Midirabanan, Afa Sofer, also the scribe who writes the contract in which they enter into. All these guys are all over Isurim from the Torah. Now the truth is, we're about to list out what the Isurim are. The Mishnah's going to list six of them. And the truth is, there's two more that the Mishnah doesn't list. Not all the Isurim are applicable to all of the characters just listed, but we'll do piece by piece and then we'll say what they are. How could a scribe not know that he's making an interest bearing contract? He writes the contract. Like anything, if he's unwitting, so then he'll be an onus, or a shogeg, or he's still over. That's not what he's doing. So the crime will be less severe, but. Okay. Now, so here they are. First of all, they're over in the Mishum Lo Siten, the Isra of Lo Siten. This is from Bahar. This actually is really two different Lavin. The Pasuk says, Es Kaspacha Lo Siten Lo Beneshech, don't give your money to him at interest. V'marvis Lo Titen Achlecha, don't give your food at ribis. So the fact that these are actually two separate lavin, but they both apply to both, whether you're lending money or food, you're over both, like the double-barreled iser. It's learned out from the fact that it didn't say, es kasvacha lo titen lo beneshech, and your food don't give at marbis. It didn't say that. That would have been like one neshech for money and one marbis for food. But here, the way it's written, I'll read the pasuk again. Es kasbacha lo siten lo beneshech uvamarvis lo titen achlecha. So since it has the two isurim like in the middle, you're over neshech and marvis for the money as well as for the food. That's the end of the pasuk. But two isurim, there's no difference. It's like you're like bal yiram bal yimatzeh, like in Pesach, it's talking about chametz. You're over two isurim every time you have chametz in your possession. Two different names. So here too, there's two different isurim, but it's like the same isur. You're over twice.
Two for one.
Yeah, and there's more than two. That's the first one. So it's the first two actually. And umishum bal tikach meito, the pasuk that prohibits taking interest from him. The pasuk says al tikach meito neshech v'tarbis. Don't take from him neshech and tarbis. So again, that's a prohibition of taking interest. That's one isur, and it is prohibiting, like the first one, is going directly on the lender, so too this one's going directly on the lender, you may not exact interest out of the person to whom you give the money, and if you do, you're over the lav. So that those three so far are all pointing the finger at the lender, particularly. The fourth is, Mishum lo siya lo kidnosha. Don't be like a lender to him. That's the best translation I have. But it means, the pasuk says, it says, in kesef tilva es ami, if you will lend money to my people, es ani imach, the poor man with you, lo siya lo kenosha, don't be like a lender to him. But it means that, because the way lenders work is they demand payments. And repayment. So the point here, it's again pointing his finger at the lender, saying the lender is not allowed to press his borrower from repayment of interest. It seems like from Rashi that you would actually, this is, the assumption is people who lend money at interest want their money back. So that they're like, that's their business. So therefore, it's assumed that by lending interest, you'll also be pressing the borrower to pay you back the money, principal plus interest. But it sounds like from Rashi, if you'd be not pressing him, if you'd be totally passive and not forcing him to repay you, you wouldn't be over this love as a lender. That's how Rashi sounds. Others say, like Magid Mishnah, that as far as best I understand them, if you've got, like, the fact there's a loan out there that's, you know, racking up interest is pushing him to repay you. There's two ways to push someone to repay you. Either put in a penalty clause, like when I write a contract, people, like, we have a standard clause in our contract that says once this goes into delayed payment, it just automatically starts, we don't care what you're quibbling about, but whatever it is, 1.5% a month, or the most that the law will allow us to charge you. That's like a penalty clause. Penalty clause built in right away. Not that you can't do that necessarily. But anyways, but the point is that you was, instead of me suing the guy immediately, if the clock starts ticking, you immediately have to pay more. So it's pushing him psychologically and, you know, monetarily. So the Magid Mishnah seems to understand that once you put in a clause that says you have to pay interest payments, that automatically pushes him to pay you back now or soon, or sooner than later. So then redeem you over the ISR just by the fact that you've got interest accruing on the debt.
So the typical tactics would be collecting these like hours in the night.
Well, that's for sure, ISR. That's for sure this ISR, according to everybody. Right, that's a Rosh Lech. But it assumes that even, yeah, like any, there's a law we saw, there's a law of pressing someone to repay you. That law actually applies to, even without interest, to press someone to repay you who can't repay you, that's a law. And we saw in Bav Metzia here that that's a separate law on top of that special additional one we saw by Onas Tavarim. There's the tax on the end when you can't lo sono, especially there's a mitzvah not to oppress converts as a separate onas davarim, and they're just put on the end also that you can't also press them lachat, you can't pressure him to repay you, that was a separate law also. So pressuring people to repay when they can't repay you is a law in its own right. If they're a convert, it's two law, and if there's interest accruing, then it's three law, and just on that by virtue that you're pressing him to repay you.
There?
Then you're allowed to.
You're allowed to, right?
Yeah. It's always a tricky question. What does it mean they can't? But yeah, indeed. If they could pay you and they're not, then they're bad people. You're taking the basin. Yeah.
The question is, what's the spirit of the word, the language? Is it pressing? The fact that the interest clock is running is not necessarily pressing. I mean, it is psychological in some level, but it's really not.
Okay, so that's Rashi.
The spirit of what's
so that's, well, that's, well, Rashi is with you. Rashi is saying it's I have to push him. You're not pushing him, the fact that it's just accruing the mechanism. But and
they have an agreement from before,
so it's okay. So that's right. So well, like Rashi, and Magid Mishnah is that it's the assumption is when people lend at interest also pressure to get, it's a package deal, but it may not necessarily be a package deal. In other words, the Mishnah is assuming if you charge interest, you're also going to engage in pressure tactics to get your money back because you're in the business. So then you're over. If you wouldn't make any people about it, you wouldn't be over this particular love. Okay. Now, so those all are pointing the finger at the lender specifically. Now here, the number five is Mishum, the Isra of Lo Tasimun Alav Neshech. Now this is like a passive construction. You shouldn't place upon him like the Neshech, the interest predicament. The pasuk says, yeah, Lasimun Alav Neshech. You can't place him into a neshech situation. So that's not charging neshech, that's not forcing neshech, that's not pressuring neshech. It's you're facilitating a neshech arrangement. So this is the one that's going to include the arev, the guarantor, as well as the edim. So in other words, the witnesses. These guys, and the chacham added the sofer to it also. These guys are facilitating a lender to put a borrower into a predicament of needing pay interest. So this one, lo to simon olav neshech, don't put him into a interest-bearing predicament, that's my word, predicament, that is a love, and that love applies, this is the love that applies specifically to the other people besides the lender and the borrower, the arev and the edim, the guarantor and the witnesses, as well as Mitzvah Rabban and the sofer. And the sixth one mentioned in the Mishnah is, umashum V'lifnei iver lo sitan michshol, v'ra'esim elokech ani Hashem. Don't put a stumbling, literally, don't put a stumbling block in front of the blind and fear God. I'm God. I don't translate. It doesn't matter. Let me just explain. This is a much bandied about Isser of putting a stumbling block in front of the blind. Let me explain it just for a second. The Isser of losit mikshol, not putting a stumbling block, is facilitating, is helping someone to break a Torah commandment. If you help someone to break a Torah commandment, then you're into losit mikshol, don't put a stumbling block territory. Now, whether you're over derisa or not actually will depend upon whether or not the person could have done it without you. If you wouldn't have done it, then couldn't have done it without you, then I don't know. I mean, it would depend on the case. Because, well, I'll say would have, as opposed, in this context, I'll say would have. Because could have is, and you could do anything, like, nothing, but, so we'll say would have. If you enable him to do it, and without you, he wouldn't have done it, so then you are now over the doraisa of Lusid and Mikshel. You set him up for the fall. That's the obvious metaphorical language here. You're setting the guy up for a fall. He's blind, and as much as he doesn't see the consequences of, all the consequences of, you know, burning in Gehenna for what he's going to do, and you set him up for it, and you know what I'm reminded of? A lot of times when we were kids, like, you would have, like, one person would, like, get down on his hands and knees behind the other guy, and then this other guy would push him over, and he'd, like, the poor guy standing up would fall over, the guy was scratched up. Like, that's... think, like, that's a probably, if, I don't know what that would be called, and, you know, that's what the pasuk is, that's what the pasuk has in mind. You're setting, that's what I mean by setting him up for the fall. Like, without you, the guy wouldn't have fallen over. It's not that he's blind per se, it's that he didn't see it coming, or he couldn't help it, because you know, without you being there to be the guy over whom he falls, he wouldn't have fallen. So that's the, at least in my mind, that's the 21st century, you know, metaphor that the Torah is trying to get at. You're setting him up for the fall. So, that's when you're over the lav d'oraisa, he wouldn't have done it without you. So here, it will, certainly the lova, the borrower, is over this, because he set up the malva, there's a prohibition about, we said this, we saw four previous prohibitions about getting into five prohibitions about him getting into a interest-bearing situation, a prohibited scenario like that. So by you, the borrower, agreeing to this loan, you're facilitating him to be over the lav of making a loan. So that's why, in that case, you know, he wouldn't have made an interest-bearing loan to you had you not been there to agree to take it and pay interest. So therefore, you as the borrower are over a losita and michshel vis-a-vis him. And of course, vis-a-vis he is over the lav of letting you. The lender is over the love of losit and michshol, as much as you've entered into a forbidden relationship. We'll actually see another passage of the Torah doesn't mention also another one specifically addressing the borrower. We'll see it. I'll explain in a second. But so he's by lending to an interest, he's making you the borrower be over those love, and also so he's also over losit and michshol. As far as the other characters, the arev, the sofer, the edim, sofer and the rabbanon. Whether or not they'll be over this will depend upon whether or not the lender was prepared to lend without Edom or without the Arevim. In other words, I want to lend to you at interest. So if I'm prepared to, if I would have, that's what would have as opposed to could have, if I would have loaned you the money without having a shtar, you know, verbally, with two witnesses and a guarantor, I wouldn't need any paperwork, then the sofer is certainly not over this doraisa of... That's a Durban, would be Doraisa. It's not over the Doraisa of Losit and Michshol. Right? Because without him, we could have done the lender would have made a loan anyways. And similarly, let's say the Edom, if the lender would have made the loan, interest-bearing loan, with a contract and a guarantor without witnesses, again, then the witnesses are not over the Doraisa of Losit and Michshol, because it would have happened without them. And the same goes, the Arev, if the lender would have made a loan with witnesses and paperwork, but no a guarantor, then the guarantor is not over the Isra Doraisa. So potentially they're all over this door. They're all at least with their bun. You can't do that. But the Doraisa, if it would have happened without the guy's participation, he would not be over the doraisa of Lifnei Iver.
I think we're all open to be responsible for putting stumbling blocks in front of blind. So my question is, at what point are you not?
When? What? Huh?
For being example, you're not putting stumbling block in front of the blind.
In what context?
So
serving them junk food at the Shabbos table? Serving them sugar at the Shabbos table? Is that what you're talking about?
No.
Like what?
Okay, so you're here in Israel, you call someone in America, it's their Shabbat. You can't do that because obviously they're going to pick up the phone.
That's Lifnei Iver, yeah.
Pick up the phone anyway, so of course you're putting someone for the...
Betzach, that's Lifnei Iver.
What about sending an email?
I would think the same. That's what I'm saying. I think in all situations you're chayav, so when are you not? I'll give you one more example. Last night I'm out with some people and there's a guy who... I can be the guy that bought the coffee and the sandwich for some guy who wasn't from. So I'm thinking as I'm buying it, paying for it, he's going to eat this bagel and not...
Make a bracha.
Right? So, you know, my chayav... Sort of last night.
These are taka all problems of the Lifnei Iver.
That's what I'm saying. So you're always, when are you not, is what I'm saying.
Well, you're not over the...
Like, some might argue that...
It's a funny thing.
Anyway.
Like, I'm not over the Iver right now. Yes, indeed, you're correct. Every time you're helping someone to be over an Avera, you're over this Isser. If they would have managed it without you, then you're over Madura Bonner, perhaps, only. But...
They would have bought that bagel probably on their own anyway.
Right, if I had paid, he would have bought it. He still would have not washed.
You may at that point would be over something like a lesser crime called a siyul advar avera. It means like, I don't know which is in English. Like, in English, they have two crimes, aiding and abetting. I'm not exactly sure. I know, yes, aid is to help them, and abet is to encourage. But so it could be that siyul is only encouraging, so to speak. You weren't actually the accomplice of the crime, you just were like the encouragement.
What if you have an unfrom person over your house for Shabbos? He doesn't wash.
These are all real problems.
That's what I'm saying. So you're always responsible. So I'm saying, when are you not? Are there any situations where you're not?
Yeah, well, sometimes there are different heterim. Sometimes I didn't force. In other words, if I serve you food and you choose not to make a bracha, I'm not over Lifnei Iver, especially if you know you're supposed to have it.
Buy a sandwich. He's going to buy a sandwich anywhere, but if you buy it for him, you're still
there. Yeah, we know.
Indeed.
It depends. It's a different person, maybe doesn't
know. So, you talk, I might have a problem, but you might have to put him on notice. Or if you know he's going to not do it. For example, your little old grandma who can't feed herself and wants to put sauerkraut in her mouth for her. That's about my great-grandmother. Great-great-grandmother. Is that done? So that taco would be with Lifnei Iver because you're shoving it down her throat. Putting it in front of her, there's more wiggle room. What did you do? You didn't do anything. But it's problematic. It is problematic. You want to know when you're over the derais and you're over the derabanan?
No, I'm saying, when is it?
You need heterim through any of this stuff.
Pretty much
I don't know, all situations. Right. Yes, you're right. You're not allowed to facilitate people to do avaras. Correct. What do you want from me?
No,
yeah.
So
sometimes they need to get you. It's a halachically nightmarish situation if you're feeding people that aren't going to say brachas and invite them and interact with them on their Shabbos and stuff like that. But yeah. Yes, I'm agreeing with you.
I guess you should make the bracha. Yeah, but you know what? On the other hand, you might be showing them Shabbat. They might
so then you might have to rely on a heter to be allowed to do it. But that's like different. Right? In other words, you're like saying, when is going to the hospital in your car not breaking Shabbos? Yes, you're right. It's breaking Shabbos every time. Let's assume that. But it might be allowed. I'm learning that for people from Nefesh, it's called Dechuya. I forget. I don't really play Shabbos, but let's assume that. I know what I meant by that. You know what I meant by that. What I meant by that, I'll just say it out. It's not clear if when you like say you're saving a life, potentially saving a life, if the laws of Shabbos are just suspended, like, you know, there's an overlay, it's a mutter, they're just pushed aside, or if they're totally now that it's permissible to do it. No, Shabbos doesn't include saving a life. But let's assume for a second that it's just dechuya, it's just that I'm ignoring the laws of Shabbos because something supersedes it, saving a life, let's say. So you're right, every time you go to the hospital, and you have to ask the rabbi, what about my mother-in-law, and what about, can I also park it, and like, can I turn off the engine, like, some things you can, some things you can't do. So indeed, if you're inviting a not from person to your house, you've got like a whole host of concerns to worry about. And when you're dealing with someone, yeah, for sure.
This question comes up in my industry, playing music from non
for mixed crowds, for mixed dancer crowds. So some musicians won't do it. The rabbis that I asked, and some serious guys, said it's not a problem because they're going to mix dance regardless of you playing. You're just doing your job. And you're not causing them to dance. Yes, they're dancing to your music, but they're going to dance if another band
is. So all the stuff is like,
so he said
needs
it's
a
not,
rabbi,
it's
really.
Not a favor, but that's also very.
All the stuff needs a rabbi.
Use that argument.
A lot of people won't play every fancy party. Basically.
Well, sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Email anyway. They would send out an email.
Well, they wouldn't answer you if you didn't. They wouldn't answer your phone if you didn't call them.
But not your phone, okay.
So that's a more of a problem.
So you could say, well, they wouldn't listen to your music if you weren't the one playing it.
I understand, but maybe yes, maybe no.
I
on the one hand, on the one hand,
a grandson said that you're not being over the neighbor because they would do it regardless. You're just doing your job playing music. You will be there, another band will play. And you're not changing
yet,
who they
just,
are.
You have to come on that. You have to come on to that.
But he's a pretty big guy to say that, because a lot of musicians won't play.
You have to come on to that far step, which is, if you wouldn't be there, they would have gotten someone else instead of you to play.
And they would have been dancing.
Which is quite a far stretch, because there's no one here now. Let's hear that point.
So if we wouldn't be playing, another band would be playing, and they'd be mixed.
No, but I just
we're not causing them to dance.
I'm not telling you no. I'm just telling you the other side of the story. The story is it's not true what you're saying. In as much as at 9 p.m. you know, on a Thursday night, if you would be playing, there would be no other band there, so they would not be dancing to your music.
No, it's not a wedding you're talking about.
What?
At weddings.
But who's the band?
Whoever's
flying Congress. But you just hear my subtle point. I'm not telling you different. I'm just hear the point. I'm saying.
Wouldn't be there.
No, but now that you are there, if you wouldn't play, there wouldn't be somebody else there. What do you mean?
No, you showed up and then you didn't play.
What do you mean?
But if we wouldn't play, we'd never be in business.
Right now, no one's gonna dance. They start playing music. So as soon as they start playing music, they start to dance. So you are doing it. That's the other side of the story.
But we're doing our job.
But that doesn't make it right. You'll have to come on to something much more, like, you have to reach farther.
Okay.
You have to reach something farther. Like, I'm just pointing out to you. It's not the same as
well,
these.
He went further. He said you can play in a gay bar.
What?
So maybe you didn't need a rabbi. But
that's your much pricey ransom.
I don't care who he is. Maybe.
It's the same principle, because you're not making them gay. I mean, you're not.
Well, okay, so if you're entering into entities, listen. If you're entering into these problems, you need to ask a rabbi. Really, yeah, these are halakhically complex issues. So is a guy selling kosher cheese at a baseball game where he knows people are eating hot dogs at a 17-inch stretch, and he's selling kosher at 8 o'clock over Lifnei Iver? Like this, yes, these are all halakhically problematic questions, and you need to get ahead to relying on. Oh, but most people don't, like, and stuff like that. You understand? But if most people do, and you're setting up the fall, and if that you providing cheese, it wouldn't be over there, blah blah, then you have a problem in your hands. Yeah. So like, you'll need to consult the rabbi.
You sell cold cuts, and you sell cheese. Separate parts of the store. Somebody comes in and buys both, makes a sandwich, and
yeah. So okay. So they're agreed. I'm saying it's all in the same category of problem. Although there, the answer, the heterim will come along the lines of this hetero, which is, yeah, without you, they would have done it anyways. You're not abetting them, encouraging them, facilitating them to do nevera. You're just selling cheese. Like, they would, you know, you can do nevera with anything. Right?
And you're a market. Yeah.
It's really
the same. I mean, you could be in that widget selling business, and I could take your widgets and kill someone with the widget. That doesn't mean, like, you're accessory to the crime, because you provided the murder weapon. Like, that, the cheese would be the murder weapon, but that doesn't make stuff get it with the cheese.
But don't have what? To dance.
But all these things need... All these things need a... I'm not asking anything, because all these things need a shiloh. No, there's so many subtleties. If you, because you end up relying on things like, what you can presume people will and won't do. It's not so simple. Like, being the purveyor of a Subway sandwich shop is different than selling cheese and meat in your grocery store. Because when you're there, you're putting cheese and meat on the sandwich for them. Or that's how the sandwiches are off the menu. It's like they're different, you know. Even if it's kosher that way, I'm saying whatever. I'm saying so there's different. Everything needs a question. You got to ask a real question if you're involved in any, you know, shady business dealings and stuff. Whatever, it's a problem. It's a potential problem. It needs to be asked.
It's not asking for a guy to have us in the
No. Not a problem at all. So what about, but the Jews are patronizing your store?
Yes, absolutely.
So you have a problem in your hands. Like, a problem. You have a problem in your hands, maybe you'll have a theorem. But, you know.
Facilitating.
Yep, you are facilitating. Like with all these things, yeah, ask a Charlotte, it depends. Like, that's each thing. You see, first of all, you have to have a rabbi, because you can see some rabbis will, this is a great area, some rabbis will be like rolling their eyes like, no, you can't do that. And some rabbis will say, very creative rabbis will say, oh, they'd be going to a gay bar elsewhere anyway, so the fact that you're, like, there's like a, you know, so, certain things are more problematic than others, obviously. Calling someone on their Shabbos would be obviously more direct. They're picking up the phone based on your stimulus.
What about sending them an email?
It's less. Sending them emails less. They don't have to respond to you now. Because they don't have to respond to you now. They can respond to you on the Shabbos.
People see their emails.
Yeah, but that's different. But that's. I'm just saying that's a step down.
Yeah, they don't respond to the phone call either.
But an email means an online
letter. No. That is obviously not the same thing. It's obviously not the same thing. The phone, you're making them pick it up.
Why are you making them pick it up?
You're bringing their phone.
They don't have to pick it up.
But you know they will if
they Yitzchak, according to that logic, then you'll never be over the Eber.
Right.
Because you don't have to make the loan. Just because I'm going to guarantee it, I'm going to write the contract, I'm prepared to guarantee it and borrow from you. You don't have to. You can back away. But I'm facilitating it. I'm helping you to do it.
They're already on the computer.
So maybe when you send emails on Friday afternoon, they're going to respond to you on Saturday.
It becomes
these things become usher when they're forced into it on Shabbos
direct result.
If you say like I need to respond in the next 24 hours and you send it to him an hour before Shabbos, you know, then you're forcing him to answer you on Shabbos. That's different.
Yeah.
There's these things all need questions. But you don't have to assume people can respond to emails on Shabbos.
Don't look at
this
until after Shabbos.
That's good.
Also, by the way, there are other issues here about the rice and the rabbanim, by the way. And picking up a phone is probably the rabbanim, and answering emails is probably the rabbanim, by the way. You have more leniency in the rabbanim than over the rice as well. Doesn't make it good, but you have a lot more wiggle room in the rabbanim than the rice. Right? In other words, you have to be afraid you're going to send someone a letter, like. But sending them a letter that could arrive on Shabbos is different. Let's say picking up a phone is a Doraisa. It probably isn't. But if they get the mail on Saturday, they're going to open it up. And if they get the phone, they're going to pick it up. But there could be different Isurim involved.
You have little control over when a letter is being delivered.
If you do, but sometimes you have second day guaranteed delivery, then you have lots of control. No, it depends. Everything depends. Okay? All these things need a Shabbos. They all need to be asked. Yeah. It's like there's too many, many, many factors. Oh, this kind of person always answers on the spot, et cetera, et cetera.
But you see, by not asking, you allow it. I'll give you an example. There are certain movements within Yiddishkeit where they know people will come to their shul on Shabbos, they'll drive there, and they don't say don't.
But you're not forcing them to drive. They're doing acting. I'm opening shul. So they want to drive. I'm not being lifted over the
fence.
What?
They're not having Shabbos.
They're not there yet.
All these things need to check.
The question is, do you have the parking lot open? That's what the question is. Do you close the shul parking lot?
Well, do you have to close the shul parking lot?
Right. So that's weird. That's where the whole
they were allowed to drive to the shul or something.
And then there's a separate question if that means justifies it. It's a question. These are all like complex. Really, really, really. Really, all these things, there's no...
Because if the shul's parking lot is open on Shabbos,
what is the difference is open or closed?
Sometimes it's proper to send a message that are just we are turning a blind eye to you driving to shul, but we are our parking lot is closed. That might be part of the heter to allow people to come in when you know full well. There is just a small tiny illustration that I'll everything needs a shadow. Let's say, for example, you're inviting someone over to your house for Shabbos Friday night. Leave the... So, now, they're going to... They're going to come before Shabbos. They're going to leave at 11 p.m. on a Friday night in their car.
So,
right. So how do you get around that problem? Right? So there are poskim who say, well, I know, but
there's a place within the state, so.
So there are poskim who say that you have to extend an invitation for them to go over. Some poskim say that's ridiculous, because no one, like in England, no one in all the years I had 1,000 people in my house, for different people in my house on Friday nights, not one ever took up that offer. So like it's not going to happen. In England, it's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. No one's going to stay in a stranger's house, period. In America, maybe 1 out of 1,000. But in England, it's like 0 out of 1,000,000. There's no chance of it happening. And the one who wants to sleep over at your house is the person who's like, you know, a child molester. So you don't want to. Really, you do not want anyone to sleep. They have something very bad up their sleeve. They want to sleep over at your house. Really, it's bad news. That I did have. That is a real example. That is an example I have. That really happened.
Your home?
Yes, that really happened to me. It really happened to me. I didn't know until what? No, really, I didn't know, and I did not know. And this the person wants to sleep over. Anyways, I was having like bad vibes and like blah blah blah. Anyways, like not good. So like yeah. So like, but what's the point? So some people will mutter having over. Some people will say you're not over lifting the ever if you're giving them a way out, which is you're welcome to sleep over. Some say you need to have a guest room for real. Some say you don't, because they could theoretically sleep on the floor if they wanted to, whatever it is, you've invited them. Some say you don't, the whole thing is a non-thought, you don't need to make such an offer in the first place. Like, there's different posts, but I'm just giving an illustration. So let's say that's one hetter. So once I didn't force you to leave anymore. I told you an out. You have an out. You can stay.
So you have to park somewhere else?
Park somewhere else.
No, you leave 1 o'clock after the meal's over.
Well, I don't care what the neighbors think. We're not talking about that. Huh. So what?
Marzine?
What Marzine was? I don't know where
you're
going.
It's not
you driving.
It's not a Marzine problem. It's not a Marzine problem. I mean, no, it's not a... I mean, it's a problem driving a Shabbos, but it's not like...
Hey,
no.
You
huh?
Why is that different than the shul parking?
No, so the shul might take a position that they want to send a message. In other words, it's a concern... I'm a rabbi in a conservative shul, and I know like all the congregants drive every day. So I'm there to let's say that's mitzvah to do. Want to give that mitzvah to do? So now, and I know full well when I convene Friday night services, you know the entire crowd with their you know microphones and tambourines are all driving into shul. So maybe the message. So maybe that's mitzvah. It's also let's say it's mitzvah, but maybe part of the hetter will be the same kind of thing. That the message is everyone. I'm not telling you. Like I'm not. We're not discussing if you should drive to shul. You know, if you want to discuss it, you know what I'm going to tell you. But what I am telling you is the shul parking lot is closed. Like, that might be part of the, as opposed to encouraging it by saying the shul parking lot is open, because then you're really, you know, then it's like sending the email on Shabbos. Like, you're inviting them for a response.
Well, the conservative shuls don't do this. The Orthodox, what do we call conservative shuls?
Whatever, I'm just, everything needs, but every post, you know what,
a lot of people would drive, so they close
the Art Scroll, if you want to go up Moti Shabbos, go to artscroll.com. On Moti Shabbos, go to what?
What is it?
I don't know. But if you go to artscroll.com on Moti Shabbos, it will say this site is closed for 25 hours in honor of the Sabbath.
Really?
In New York Times.
In New York Times, right?
In New York Times. They don't have to do that. They don't have to do the pashas. But that's like a policy decision. Why are they doing that? Because they want their parking lot to be closed on Shabbos,
right.
Even though people can do it before and after, and they can do part of it. They can do it on their Shabbos because they're from Los Angeles and it's going to be Shabbos still. You know, it's Saturday afternoon. It's almost, but like they're making the policy decision because they want to send the message.
I don't know if it's still true, but the website, you get on it and say, your computers are also, you should be on it. So what do you have a website for?
I've actually had a situation where I had gigs once a Shabbos, like up in Albany, and I had to send a band up there. So I'm trying to get you know, going. It's not always possible to hire Jews. So I've been told that they got to drive on Shabbos to get this for once a Shabbos. I've been told it's not a problem because I'm not telling them. So I was by myself, extra mafia, and I offered all of the Jewish musicians to put them in a hotel on me. Every single one. None of them took me up on it, but I said, I'll put you up in a hotel so you're like 5 minutes away from this place, so you can stay there on Shabbat. And in case you don't have somebody to stay by in the name of it, I'll put you on a hotel. No, don't worry about it, we'll take care of it.
Well, all they say need a conflict. They just need a, need a conflict. Well, all these questions are not halakhic matters.
Knowing that I didn't give them an option. So, right.
So yes, the Rav Lunitz is perfectly confident.
I think it's halakhic.
I don't know.
It's definitely Yotze. A true story. A person was reading Rav Miller's book, or a few books, and he comes to New York and says, I have no place to stay. So, of course, Rav Miller, can I stay by you? So, that, of course, comes and stays by him. The Rav didn't sleep the whole night. He didn't sleep the whole night. And he says, tomorrow, I'm going to call up Satma, and I'm going to get you a place to stay.
But he couldn't sleep because there was a stranger in his house.
What's that?
He couldn't sleep because there was a stranger in his house.
Yeah, he couldn't sleep the whole night. He didn't sleep the whole night.
Yeah, you don't know.
Yeah, you know.
Well, I've had many in my business. I've had strangers in my house all the time, but so it's worked out. I never had anything bad happen. Never had anything bad happen to me, for the record. What? But yeah, but you're
all this guy's out of the blue.
I understand. No, I'm with you.
This is during the week.
Yeah.
We had a single stay with us once, and they took us up on the offer. Whatever, it was a girl, so we were worried, but like
California.
Yeah, but like it was like she like put sheets all around the world. I'm like, it was my office, dude. And I'm like she did all this weird stuff in our house, and I was like, and she was really nice. She was just eclectic.
Right.
Yeah,
so that's California. California's a different world than
that. No, on there.
So, anyway, so let me. Bottom line on this Lifnei Iver business, yeah, you got to feel for the potential problems across the board. You need to ask with all these things. You need to ask a shayla. Like really, Rav Lunitz was a perfectly competent posek. He can feel this question, but these are like heavy. When you talk about Chilul Shabbos, it's like heavy, really heavy duty stuff. So you got to consult with the rabbi on that one.
It depends on who you're dealing with,
too. Like, I'll tell you, without getting into all the details, because like, there are too many details now, but Rav Berkowitz, who was my posek in Aruch Chaim and stuff, so he is mater inviting people to come for Shabbos, even if you don't think of big Shabbos. But without all the small details, the basic gist of it is because it's based on the Gemara that talks about how you're allowed to be Mechal Shabbos for someone once, they'll keep Shabbos the rest of their life.
Yeah, right.
Okay? And this is even better than that, because you're not being Mechal Shabbos. They're being Mechal Shabbos to save their own life. Kilo. Anyways, so this is a serious question that came up. The thing is, if you don't invite the Shabbos and never know about Shabbos, they're never going to keep Shabbos. So then the Heter comes in, you're allowed to invite them for Shabbos because this will be the thing that will be a stepping stone to keeping Shabbos. Now, here's what happens. Let's say it's all kosher, v'yosher, everything's cool. There are plenty of posts who like to say, no way, Jose. Yeah, plenty. But anyways, we're working specifically Mekla here. Let's say it's mutter. So every week, what happens is every week, people start to come more and more from that. They become like, they do Shabbos every Friday night, you know, and then twice the Shabbos, the Friday night and Shabbos day. So they start coming every single week to your house. Fine. At some point, you have to say, I can't have you over anymore. Because they know what Shabbos is. Coming to you another Shabbos is not going to make them want to keep Shabbos anymore or less. Either they will, they won't. But this is no longer. And it happened to us. Yeah, we would say usually to the other person. It's hard to see it in your own from your own perspective like this. And you become. But we'd say to like the other rabbi, like I don't think you can invite me anymore. Or they have to sleep over. Like they have a choice to make now. And that was always a rough phone call. And by the way, a lot of times we went over very well. You basically listen, like you explain to them, you have to have a phone call. You have to say, listen, Johnny, this is the situation. You explain the whole scenario to them. And you say, yeah, I'm happy you to come, but I can't invite you anymore if you're going to be Mechal Shabbos because you know too much.
You can always make the argument. You really didn't know, you wouldn't do it. I mean, you can make that argument.
No, but here's a subtle point. The question isn't if they know or didn't know. That's not the point. We're not talking about if this is a critical invitation for them to ultimately keep Shabbos. So that it's not. They could. Let's say, for example, a person says, "I know, but it's just too hard for me now," which plenty of people say.
I mean, they really don't know.
No. I mean, they know about Shabbos.
You're not ready to take it on.
No. Then, yeah.
The Shabbos brothers used to.
Yeah.
Covering your hair. Yeah.
That happens a lot.
Eating strictly kosher from non. It's
a problem. So I would even encourage people to do it slowly and everything. You know, there's plenty of places that you cannot do that. But anyway,
so what do you tell them?
So at some point you'd say, listen, so I want you to understand that I cannot invite you for Shabbos anymore if you're going to drive home because I can't cause you to break Shabbos anymore. Most of them ended up becoming Shomer Shabbos, like, still without that. And this, what happens is they would come less frequently when they weren't prepared to commit a whole weekend. You know, but it takes time. You have to at some point that call has to be made. I'm saying that's something that's become very, very, very thorny. And then in a way, like, you have a big problem. Like, not only do you need a rabbi, but you need a rabbi who's prepared to, like, has to have his head open to hear the whole scenario. Because no longer now it's totally idiosyncratic. It's this particular human being, and the particular rabbi have to say, start asking you questions. Well, what if? Do you think that? Would they agree to? How they feel about? Like, have to really size up. Like, have you ever experienced, like, the question of, like, 2 days Yom Tov, or 1 day Yom Tov, when you first came to Eretz Yisrael? I don't know if any of you had that experience. So, like, you have, like, no Rav will pass out of a telephone. And not no Rav. Any Rebbeim who want to... some rabbis said, like, a Shita, that it's a black and white issue. In which case, if it's a black and white issue, then it's a non-starter. Then it's a non-starter. But most normative poskim do not look at it as a black white issue, and it's all about what's going on in your head. What's going on in your head. So I can't tell what's going on in your head until I just have a discussion about how you feel when I say home, what do you think about, and where's your support, and how do you feel if your parents cut you off, and what happened. Like, it's, you have to get a picture. You need a poskim. Okay. Let me finish this. Well, let me finish. The Mishnah, we finished the Mishnah, but I want to have something more to say about the Mishnah. Which is, there are two more Isurim that the Mishnah doesn't speak out. Right. So, one pasuk says, "Lo tasich la'achicha neshech." Don't. It's like a hefil. Don't enable your brother. No, don't enable your brother to charge interest, something like that. The translation is tricky, but the point is, it's not lo tashoch. Don't charge interest. It's lo tashich. Don't, like, cause interest to be charged to your brother, right? Neshech kesef, neshech ochel, neshech koldover, asher yashech, yo yeshach, anything that can you charge interest on. That iser, lo sashich, not lo sishoch, is looked at as a law pointing finger at the borrower, specifically the borrower. The other psukim talked about the lender, don't charge interest. This is like a hefil, don't cause interest to be charged, looked at as a pointing to the borrower, not to, specifically the loba, the borrower, not to enter into a neshech relationship. And also, there's also another pasuk, which is, the next pasuk, which says, "Lenochri tashich," to a non-Jew you may allow to enter into an interest relationship. "Ulachicha lo sashich," but to your brother you may not. And that also is looked at as a second, like a double-barreled lav against the borrower going into this relationship. So those are the lavim that points to the borrower. So in the end, when the dust settles, you have the six we said before in the Mishnah that point at the malve, the lender, that assumes it may only be knocked down to five according to the one that talks about pressuring him. Right? If you're not, like Rosh, if you're not pressuring him, you're down to five, but there's six potentially there. The lova the sixth one he's over of Losita and Michshol, the stumbling block, is because of these last two. The lender is over Los Sitan Michshol, the stumbling block, because the borrower has two Asurim, which aren't mentioned in the Mishnah. So that's a total of six. The borrower has three, the two we just mentioned that aren't mentioned in the Mishnah, and the Los Sitan Michshol, stumbling block for the lender. And the Edim and the Arev, and maybe the Sofer, has one or two. They would have one of the actual prohibition of not setting up a neshech relationship, and then the second one, potentially, if the lender would be makpid to have an arev or a sofer or an edim, in which case you're over a listed michshel, also the stumbling block from the blind, so one or two for them. Okay?
So there's no issue for
them to be enablers? There is. I'm saying, well, it depends. That will be over. When you say enablers, you don't mean listed michshel. There's one law that talks
about.
The stumbling block from the blind. So then they'd be over the Doraisa if the lender wouldn't have done the transaction without them. Otherwise, they're only over Durabanim. In our discussion all the time, we were talking about differentiating Doraisa from Durabanim. But, you know, if the lender's prepared to make a loan, I don't need paperwork. If I have you witnessing it, I'm happy. Then the person writing it down is not over the Doraisa. Maybe the Durabanim, they're enabling, but not the Doraisa without them would still happen. So then they're not over the law of the rights of Sid Mitchell, opening the block. Tov. And with that, we finish the sixth parak. Baruch Hashem. Tomorrow, I will, Lineder, just go over the Iska relationship. But I just want to just basically show you the contracts, just to speak about briefly how banks work and how general things work. That also, of course, need a rub for. But then we'll go on. It won't take, you know.